it had been up to that point in time the most successful year of his career. The River was his fifth record. It was a double record. It was his first number one record. It scored his first top 10 single, top five single, really, in Hungry Heart. First full-scale tour of Europe had happened, and he came back to the States, and so he wraps up the River tour in Cincinnati in mid-September. And it's about 11 months after the album's release. And he arrives back in New Jersey pretty much a homeless millionaire. He'd been drifting for the past 4 years between the hotels and living out of a suitcase to a rented house in Homedale, and then back to living out of a suitcase. Finally having some money, finally it was safe to say that he was a millionaire by the time he got off the River tour. But he had no intentions of purchasing his Graceland. The harshest critics would later condemn him for being rich while singing about the working class and embracing their values as if staying close to his roots made him a hypocrite or something. Anybody that doesn't like Bruce Springsteen cannot be trusted. I live by that. At this point in 1981, he's able to shrug everything off. It's the first time in his career, in his life really, that he's able to just sit back, exhale, not give a shit about anything. For once, the record label isn't on the edge, anxiously expecting something. For once, he's in total control of whatever the future's going to be, and he's going to make sure that it stays that way. Immediately, he rents another house, this time on a reservoir in Colts Neck, New Jersey. He didn't have much to do. He basically watched the seasons change from his window. He'd go out very little. A lot of accounts of this period is that he meets himself in Colts Neck. Demons, emotional voids, buried in years of playing until he dropped of exhaustion, too tired to think. All of this would rise to the surface, and that something is missing in his life. In that autumn chill of 1981, he'd write songs. He'd write new songs, but they'd be different kinds of songs. They'd be that topical direction that he hinted at when he first premiered The River 2 years earlier at the Muse concerts, the shows that became known Nukes. That topical direction had come into full fruition. So, was it a rotten mood that was going to dictate his next step? At that point, I don't think he knew. Whatever the case, he wasn't about to take it out on anyone or anything but his music. So, one day, in the quiet desolation of the lonely house, some 72 hours after the calendar flips to 1982, January 3rd, 1982, he sits down in his bedroom with an acoustic guitar and a four-track Tascam Portastudio, and he presses the record button. So in Colts Neck, Bruce Springsteen wrote music reflective of the times. It's January 1982, picking up right where the river left off. The new songs hinted at even darker places than the death of dreams. The River album at heart was still about picking up broken pieces, carrying on. These new songs left nowhere to go. The failing economy mentioned in The River was reflective of America during the Carter years. By the beginning of Reagan's second year in office, unemployment had skyrocketed to 10.8%. For decades, economists have hotly contested whether or not Reagan's tax cuts were responsible for any sort of improvement, such as a slow but eventual drop in unemployment that began in 1983 and continued over the course of his two terms in office. Regardless of what sparked the surge in job growth, Bruce Springsteen's new songs going into 1982 mirrored a country bottoming out. Early in January, he taped the new collection of acoustic demos in his bedroom. Originally intended as rough sketches for full band rock arrangements, he carried the cassette around with him, playing it often, trying to figure out how the band would be incorporated into the desolate new material. But he couldn't. Studio work began that spring. While some songs worked within the full band dynamic of the E Street Band, the primary batch that he felt was cohesive enough in its gloomy and unsettling tone didn't seem to fit the rock model. The material seemed almost too intimate for rock music, let alone other instruments. At some point, he decided to scrap the idea of integrating the band into his efforts. As a result, songs like Downbound Train, Murder Incorporated, Glory Days, Working on the Highway, Wages of Sin, and a new ballad called Born in the USA. Songs that did work in band arrangements got tossed aside in favor of the darkest and quietest recordings. When Springsteen penned Born in the USA, it was an acoustic ballad reminiscent of the old Dust Bowl era recordings later unearthed and released by Harry Smith in 1952. Born in the USA was completely contemporary, however, addressing the plight of the Vietnam vet upon returning home to a hostile public. Out of the two dozen or so songs recorded with both with and without the band, Born in the USA, recorded in several versions, was not chosen, nor were any of the studio recorded songs used for the next official release. Instead, Springsteen handed in the four-track cassette demo as his album, and the record company obliged. That Columbia released the demos in their stark and hollow condition and fully marketed as the new Bruce Springsteen album was testament to two significant factors. One, the trust and the faith that the label had in the artist. Two, the clout Springsteen had earned in the music business. To the fans, the next album would be an unexpected shock. Critics, a bold and welcome move. Regarding the album that became Nebraska, Springsteen's mood was clearly ugly. On the flip side of the river's life-affirming conclusion, the singer and narrator of Nebraska's opening song goes out and murders 10 people. On trial, he knows he's going to the electric chair and he willfully accepts his fate, asking only for his girl to be sitting on his lap when they pull the switch, so she fries too. In front of the judge, he addresses the question of why he did what he did and tells him simply that there's a meanness in the world. Mass murder in the title tracks based on the true story of Charles Starkweather, who at 19 years old went on a rampage with his 14-year-old girlfriend Carol Ann, killed 11 people in Nebraska and Wyoming. The 1957 and 58 murders shook Lincoln and surrounding towns to their core. Law enforcement sent out house-by-house searches along with the governor calling for assistance from Nebraska's National Guard. The same story and characters had already been immortalized in Terrence Malick's 1973 film Badlands. Sung in first person, Springsteen's title track sets us up for a collection of stories and situations highlighted by people affected, often direly, by outside elements of society beyond their control. And often elements from within themselves that manifest in some dreadful ways. Let there be no mistake, Nebraska is a dark and dreary album. Contrary to the characters on the river who have a sense of purpose, each playing their role in the wheel of American civil society, the characters have already become statistics in the harshest possible ways. The ones who haven't yet are barely hanging on. The album recognizes that it is easy to get to a point of complete nihilism where the laws and concerns of a functioning society become meaningless. Where the river was about looking for connection, Nebraska is about the invisibility of isolation. In Johnny 99, a guy named Ralph is out of work, desperate to find a job and faced with mounting debts that can never be paid by any honest man. He has too much to drink one night and shoots a night clerk. Sometime earlier, the bank was about to take his house away, but Ralph, now known as Johnny 99 for his sentence of 98 in the year, is going to be residing someplace much different than home. Johnny explains to the judge his situation and acknowledges that it by no means makes him an innocent man, nor does it excuse what he's done. Yet he assures the court that it's far more than what could ever be recounted that put that gun in his hand in the first place, namely those outside forces and elements at work that often break the human spirit and can result in desperate and drastic measures. Nebraska is as psychological as it is social. Characters perceive themselves as so low on the totem pole that they often address the listener as sir. Someone always has the upper hand over the people in Nebraska's songs. The album came at a time when Springsteen was still struggling to make peace with his father. Songs like My Father's House is marked by guilt, longing, and a sense of being excruciatingly haunted by an unresolved past. As always, the artist is conflicted by the archetype of the father-son relationship, as in so many of Bruce Springsteen's songs. There is no distinction between artist and character. The first-person narrative paints a depressive psychological landscape. The sense of regret against the passage and distortion of time is Bergman-esque in a Wild Strawberries kind of way. Mansion on the Hill in its warm, summery, yet foreboding imagery recalls that of an Edward Hopper painting. It's a still moment on the album reminiscent of present consciousness that gets briefly interrupted by a past memory, only to be shaken awake back into the now. Used Cars is a softer look at its father as provider and protector. Written from the eyes of a child, or as an adult, somehow seeing its past through vivid memory, the voice of the song is a witness to his father's plight. He sees and feels his humiliation in front of the car salesman, and carries the same rage his father must feel. The people on Nebraska are not all losers and murderers, however. Not all have fallen through the cracks of society and would gladly contribute to the rat race if they could only get hold of their own little piece of it. In the case of the Nebraska album, the people in its grooves would be much better served if they were able to find the most basic necessity for a life of purpose and dignity, a job. Atlantic City perhaps sums up the overall atmosphere, with a couple coming up against hard times and looking for a little piece of luck in a gambling city that's barely surviving the economy itself. The ever-present pressing on in the face of dying dreams still inevitably triumphs by the end of the album. Despite it all, the tough will survive, and even the weak who have not turned to crime manage to scrape up enough faith in each passing day by finding some reason to believe. Springsteen spent the next year and a half in the studio working on the next proper rock album, an effort he originally began for the project that became Nebraska. When it was all over, the end result was Born in the USA, an album that went on to sell over 30 million copies. That part of the story is inevitably for another time, not for this one, bearing no significance to this particular look at Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska. For the next three decades, Springsteen maintained his status as biggest rock recording artist in the world, getting ever increasingly active in politics and social justice causes. At a stop in Hammondtown, New Jersey during his re-election campaign, Ronald Reagan strayed from his usual standard stump speech with a transparent and hollow attempt at co-opting Bruce Springsteen. He told the local crowd, "America's future rests in 1,000 dreams inside your hearts. It rests in the message of hope in the songs of a man so many young Americans admire, New Jersey's own Bruce Springsteen." Well, a relentless media sought out a response from Springsteen, who, second only to Michael Jackson and maybe Reagan himself, was possibly the most famous man in America in 1984. Springsteen avoided commenting until he was on stage a few days later in Pittsburgh. He said, quote unquote, "Well, the president was mentioning my name in his speech the other day, and I kind of got to wondering what his favorite album of mine must have been, you know? I don't think it was the Nebraska album." And then he launched into the tragic and harrowing Johnny 99 and told the crowd, "I don't think he's been listening to this one."